My name is Donald. I am an alcoholic. That will become increasingly obvious in the next 20 minutes. Is that better? As it was mentioned, I have the honor and privilege of serving Area 59 as their archivist, for which I am extremely grateful. A couple months ago, I got an email from our past Northeast Regional Trustee, Jay Gary, and it said, "Are you going to the International? Be careful how you answer. I have an ulterior motive." I dearly love Jay Gary and have the utmost respect for him, but in the years I've known him, he has never done anything without having an ulterior motive. So here I am. If you have any problems, I will be more than happy to point him out to you. He's the gentleman that's balding in the shorts. I asked him what I was supposed to talk about, and he said there are three speakers. Traditionally, one of them speaks about the history. So I compiled some history on the Northeast region of the United States. So much information and so little time. I will do the best I can. I divided it into states. There are 18 areas, but that was way too much. So I'm going to start with Maine. Maine had its first AA meeting October 6, 1944, in Cape Elizabeth. But it really started in both Bangor and Portland in 1946, from which most of the other groups in Maine sprang. Bangor's first meeting took place in Jim Hughes' gas station on January 7, 1946. Bill W. visited Maine April 15, 1950 to talk at an AA conference in Brewer. There were then 30 groups with more than 600 members. My remarks about each state are going to be short because of the time limitation. New Hampshire. AA began meeting in Manchester and Portsmouth in 1946, and a year later in Concord. By 1949, there were 12 meetings statewide, and by 1955, 20 groups. The first state convention was held at the Eastern Slopes Inn in North Conway in 1966. Vermont. There is a quote. This is for Vermont. "The per capita consumption of alcohol in Vermont has always been high, so it always has had more than its share of alcoholics." Coincidentally enough, it is the birthplace of both our co-founders, both Dr. Bob and Bill W. The first group began meeting in 1944. They were first in homes, then the Congregational Church in Burlington. They put an ad in the local paper on the comic strip page because, as they put it, drunks will read the funnies when they can't read anything else. Then we go to Massachusetts. At the 1955 St. Louis Convention, Bill W. called the Boston group that wonderful nucleus from which so much of AA in New England later stemmed. He went on to say that, heartbreakingly, its founder, Patty Kay, could never get sober himself and finally died of alcoholism. Slip followed slip, but he came back to carry the AA message, at which he was extremely successful. Patty was in touch with Bill and Ruth Hawk as early as 1939. He held some kind of AA meeting Wednesday, November 13, 1940, but the first regular meeting of the Boston group was on the first Wednesday of March, 1941, at the office of a Dr. Lawrence M. Halstad. But the doctor began taking on newcomers as paying patients, soliciting contributions, and implying a connection with AA. So Patty wired Bill. He said, "You got to come up here and do something about this." Bill went up to Boston. Nobody knows exactly what happened, but a couple weeks later, the group moved to its new headquarters. There was a judge in North Adams named William O'Hearn, who may have been the first judge in the country to recognize the efficacy of AA and refer drunks to meetings. He said, "Classifying drunkenness as a crime does nothing to bring about rehabilitation." He said, "I had little faith in AA when it was first organized, but I've watched the growth and know of its splendid accomplishments. I feel that today it offers the greatest opportunity in overcoming this terrible curse." Boston also has the distinction of electing the very first delegate to the very first General Service Conference in 1951. In a meeting in the Hotel Bradford on January 14th, the names of seven committee men were put in a hat, and Bill W. drew the name of Bob G. Rhode Island. Yeah, right. Jack Q. of Providence traveled to Boston to get sober, continued going to meetings there, but in 1945 began a meeting in his own city with the help of a man named Jack D. from Boston and a man named John who had gotten sober in Akron. They met in the lobby of the Biltmore Hotel, but after a short period of time, the Biltmore Hotel asked them to leave. So they were offered a meeting place by the Round Top Restaurant in the fall of 1945, and they became known as the Round Top Group. In October 1947, the Providence Journal ran a feature article on the group titled, It Takes a Drunk to Help a Drunk. Now we go to Connecticut. This was a fun one. The beginning of AA in Connecticut is traced back to Marty M. That name should ring a bell. At the age of 32, she found herself committed to Blythewood Sanitarium in Connecticut due to her drunkenness and aberrant behavior. The medical director there was a Dr. Harry Tebow, who had been sent a multi-lith copy of the Big Book for review. He gave it to Marty to read. At first she refused, and then she read just enough so she could argue with the doctor about how these people were fanatics and she didn't believe in God and the book was useless. And shortly thereafter she found herself in an emotional crisis filled with rage, and she was stomping around her room and she looked at the bed. The manuscript was open. And she saw the line, we cannot live with anger. And Dr. Harry Tebow had been encouraging her to go to meetings, so she was escorted to a meeting at Bill and Lois's home in Brooklyn. When she returned home to Blythewood late that night, she reported to her close friend and fellow alcoholic granny the now famous statement, we aren't alone anymore. Almost immediately, they began holding meetings on the sanitarium grounds. The time was May 1939, which led Bill to say at the St. Louis Convention, some folks think this was AA group number three. Actually, it seems a dead heat tie with Clarence S.'s group in Cleveland. It is believed that Norwalk had a small AA group as early as 1940. One of the members, a man named Les, got drunk. When he got home, he got a gun and he went out into the woods vowing he was going to commit suicide. His terrified wife called all the AAs that she could think of, and they came over and they went in the woods and they searched for him. The good news is they found him and they brought him out of the woods and everybody was okay. The not so good news is they were so relieved and happy about finding him that they all went out to celebrate and all of them, but one of them got drunk. This is our history. Stratford, Connecticut has an excellent example of our hallowed AA tradition of the only thing it takes to start a meeting is a resentment in a coffee pot. In 1965, there was a meeting on Easter Sunday in Stratford, and someone brought a whole bunch of chocolate bunnies to the meeting. And towards the end of the meeting, an old-timer got up to get a chocolate bunny, and they were all gone. So he accused a man named Joe of stealing the chocolate bunnies. Enter the resentment. Next day, Joe went to the Catholic church that was right next door, talked to the Monsignor, and wanted to start a meeting. So the following week, there was a men's meeting in the basement of the Catholic Church, attended by Joe and Mary, his wife, who was there to make sure that their coffee pot got home. So now you have the resentment and the coffee pot. Nobody else came for a couple weeks. It was just Joe, Mary, and the coffee pot. But eventually people started coming, and that was the birth of the Stratford Men's Group in Connecticut. New Jersey. In April 1939, Bill and Lois found themselves homeless. They had lost their home. They found temporary quarters at Green Pond near Montclair in South Orange. So meetings began there. Lack of public interest was discouraging. Growth was painfully slow until March of 1941, when the Saturday Evening Post article came out, Membership quadrupled almost overnight, and growing pains were rampant. As the population swelled in the post-war years, so did the AA population, and groups proliferated. If you want to know more about the history of AA in New Jersey, go to the New Jersey Hospitality Suite. They have an incredible display about the history of AA in New Jersey. Baltimore and Maryland. AA in Baltimore started when Jim B. was visiting from Philly, and he met a Jim R. on June 16, 1940. 6 days later, the first group meeting was held in a lawyer's office. The reason it was in the lawyer's office was because the lawyer said he had a brother who had a problem with alcohol. Okay, fine. The Baltimore Sun ran an article on the group, including a photo from the rear. Fitz M., who was AA number 8 from Maryland, came to New York in 36. He sobered up at Towns Hospital. He met Bill, and upon returning to Maryland, he started reaching out to other alcoholics. Bill and Lois used to go down and visit him because they liked the peace and quiet, and Bill even made some of the notes for the big book down there. However, the first group did not form until 1947. Wilmington and Delaware. Jim B. was instrumental also in starting AA in Wilmington. Along with the DuPont Company, which was a dominant factor in Wilmington daily life, Dave H. was an employee of Remington Arms, which was a DuPont subsidiary in Connecticut. He had sobered up in AA and worked with alcoholics in his company up there. As the war wound down, he was laid off. So he got in touch with Wilmington DuPont, and he called him and he said that he thought the AA approach might help with their employees in Wilmington. And the management's response was, there's no alcohol problem here. Well, they had a medical director named George Gehrman, and he knew otherwise because he'd been struggling with the problem for 18 years in the company. So he had heard about AA, so he went to a meeting in Philadelphia. He met Jim B., and by the time he left that meeting, he was loaded up with 8 big books and a supply of pamphlets. He hired Dave H., and on January 14, 1944, the first AA meeting was held in Wilmington. They met 4 nights a week, and on Friday night when they called the roll, if a member was missing, they sent him a postcard that said, "We miss you," signed the group. Washington, D.C., Fitz M. previously moved to Washington in 1939. With the help of Jim B., AA got off to a good start. Jim B. was really big at hospital meetings because of a weekly meeting in Philadelphia General Hospital. So he urged the group to work with alcoholics at Gallinger Hospital. He also introduced the custom of serving coffee and donuts at meetings. 1955, there were 9 groups with over 400 members. Fitz M. died in 43, but Washington AA was firmly established by then. New York City. Bill W. returned from Akron with his meeting. From his meeting with Bob on August 26, 1935. He said, "By the time I got home, I was endowed with a little more humility, a little more understanding, and considerably more experience. Very slowly, a group began to take shape. In spite of much failure, a really solid group finally developed. The first success was Hank P. from New Jersey, followed by Fitz M. from Maryland. In the middle of 37, Bill and his friends broke away from the Oxford group. There were meetings at Bill and Lois's home at 182 Clinton Street until they lost their home in April of 39. But Lois remembered by then at least a dozen AA groups had evolved in the metropolitan area. In 56, there were 47 groups in Manhattan. In Brooklyn, there was a group called the Cold Water Group because the St. George Hotel where they met wouldn't allow them to brew coffee, so the only refreshment was cold water. Staten Island had a group in 45, Forest Hills 41, Flushing 43, Hempstead 43, Manhasset 45. In western New York, Rochester was an early center for AA activity and was the site of the first New York State AA conference on January 24, 1948. Bill W. was the main speaker, and his members gawked at him. He said, "Don't look for the halo." The first meeting in Albany group. This is Hudson, Mohawk, Berkshire. The first meeting of the Albany group was held March 7, 1943, with 4 members. By July, there were 30 members. Glens Falls, a group started in 39, and it spread to Hudson Falls, Warrensburg, Chesterton, Corinth. The first Schenectady meetings were held in a hotel in the 40s. It spread to Utica, Rome, Troy, Saratoga. In the 50s, New Paltz, Woodstock. In the 60s, Plattsburgh, Lake Placid. Then we got one state left, and that's mine. It's Pennsylvania. I could talk for a long time, but they would not. A little bit about Area 60, Western Pennsylvania. December 13th, 1940 was the date of the first AA meeting in Pittsburgh. I found an interesting little tidbit. The Mount Lebanon and Dormont groups in Pittsburgh owe their origins to the South Hills Group, which was also known as the South Hills Group, because of its slippery beginnings. It started in 1942 with 5 people and grew to 30 members, but 20 or so of them continued to drink. And there was a gentleman named F, E-P-H-F-S, one of the founders. And he said, on one occasion when none of the non-drinkers showed up, the drinkers went to a bar, had their meeting, and everybody got stinko. He also remembered they arranged to take a trip to Akron for Founders Day. But since it was going to be a long trip, they took along a couple of bottles and they never made it to Akron. This is our history, you know. This is serious stuff here. Harrisburg had a struggle getting underway. It started in 41 and by 42 had 8 to 10 people. In 1943, Harrisburg had a mid-city group which called itself the only meeting between Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. AA started in Reading in 43 by a man named George L. who attended meetings in Philadelphia. The eastern portion of the area is my area. I could talk for a long time about Philadelphia and the Lehigh Valley and Jim B. and the Saturday Evening Post article, but I need to wind it up. So I'm not going to spend any time. If you want to know more about that, see me after the meeting. There's one thing I would like to say about the importance of history in AA. A gentleman named Mitchell Kay, a well-known AA historian and author, gives an excellent presentation on why study the history of AA. What does it matter? How can it help me in my program of recovery? Basically, who cares? Well, AA is a long time thing. It's 80 years we are celebrating when we are here today. If you look at... If you look at the fellowship, I feel, as you look at a tree, the trunk of the tree is GSO. The limbs of the tree are our areas. The branches are our districts. The twigs are our groups. And the leaves are the members. But the roots of that tree, that's our history. And if you ignore the roots of a tree, that tree will surely wither and die. One more thing I want to say. 80 years ago, today, not yesterday, not last week, not next week, not next month, 80 years ago to this day, there was a man laying in a bed in a hospital in Akron. And 2 men went to visit him because they discovered that the only way they could keep from drinking was by talking to another alcoholic. And we became 3. So when you're sitting in the Georgia Dome and you're looking around, 80 years ago today, 3. That's all that would have been in that stadium. And now we have what we have today. Thank you very much for your time. Ronald, thank you.
Well, that was great. I love hearing the history of AA, and the legacy continues. Now, our next speaker is Ann. She's a current delegate from Western Massachusetts, Area 31.
I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 10th, 1998, and my home group is the STEP group. We meet on Monday night. We meet on Monday night in Holyoke, Massachusetts. Now I sound very loud. Really? Okay. You still can't hear me? How about now? Okay. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. So in 20 minutes, I 2 days before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't not drink. I had 2 little kids. They were very small. They were terrified of me. I was terrified of them. I did all that I could to avoid taking responsibility for their lives. I was effectively unemployed and unemployable. The truth is I was in a PhD program that I had 6 incompletes in, and I would have told you day after day that as I closed myself in my office, I told everybody I was in there working on my dissertation. What I was doing was playing Tetris on my computer and drinking as much rum as I could. And I had no idea that alcohol was my problem. For a very long time, alcohol had helped me survive. I was really clear that the only way I was getting out of bed in the morning was, you know, on the thought of the next drink. The day before I got to you, my partner at the time had had enough. And she let me know that she had invited a woman from Alcoholics Anonymous to dinner. And I couldn't understand why she would do that. I said, really? Really, all I understood that to mean was that I couldn't drink. All I knew is I was going to have to get through a meal, really get through a day, because if I drank before she came, I wouldn't be able to get through the meal without drinking, and so I wasn't going to drink. And I thought, that was really inconceivable situation for me at that point. But I couldn't look bad. You still can't hear? Okay, so can you hear me now? But I can't hear me now. Okay, sorry. I'm going to try hard not to snort into the microphone. Because that might happen. Okay, so Heather was coming to dinner, and I couldn't drink, and I didn't know what to do with that at all. And an hour before she arrived, my mother called. And at that point, I hadn't spoken to my mother in months, if not years. And my mom and I had a pretty difficult relationship, as you might imagine. And I was quite sure that her drinking was the problem, not mine. And one of the problems. So she told me that she had just a few months to live. She was very ill. And of course, I immediately felt terribly guilty and asked, you know, what I could do and why hadn't she called me sooner. And by the end of the conversation, what I learned was that there was nothing physically wrong with my mother. She was just fed up with or disappointed in a daughter who couldn't stay in touch. And so I didn't understand at that time, as I do today, that was my mom reaching out to me. All I knew was that she had messed with me again. And really all I knew was I was an emotional wreck and I couldn't have a drink. And I didn't know what to do given that situation. And so, so this woman from Alcoholics Anonymous comes to dinner and when she arrives at my home, I don't know how I ended up in the bathroom, but that's where I ended up, you know, in a puddle on the floor sobbing. And what I know today is that my higher power was preparing me to hear the message of hope and recovery. And so I was a wreck and I couldn't drink. And this woman comes into the house and she told me her story, which, you know, I don't remember all the details of her story, but what I know is it got my attention. She talked about having felt the way that I was feeling. She talked about coming to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she talked about getting better. And as she talked about the despair and hopelessness of her life before she got to the rooms, I really identified, and she laughed and smiled, and I didn't understand that. I thought it had been a really long time at that point since I had laughed and smiled, and certainly no one in my vicinity was doing much laughing and smiling, and so it really got my attention. And then the next thing that happened, that what I know today is, you know, the result of my higher power working in my life, is I looked across the table with all the contempt I could muster, and asked my partner if she thought I was an alcoholic. You know what? Obviously, she thought I was an alcoholic. She brought a member of Alcoholics Anonymous into the house for dinner. I think maybe I just put that together. I asked her the question, and she said, you know, if she had said, yes, I think you are, I could have, you know, flown into a rage, which was not unusual at that point, and used that as, you know, the excuse to excuse myself, dismiss Heather, and go drink the way that I needed to. And if she had said no, I could have said, see, we're just fine. Thanks for coming, and, you know, best wishes. She said, I don't know. Excuse me. And I didn't know what to do with that. I just, really, I don't know. So what I know is that that was the only answer that she could give, and the only answer that allowed me to be among you today. So Heather invited me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous the next day, and I went, and I didn't know. What I know today is it was a step meeting. They read from the 12 and 12 and then discussed. I didn't know what they were doing. I didn't know, you know, anything except that what people said, got to me. For the first time in my life, I really felt like you understood what was going on inside me. Like, here's a room full of people that are laughing and smiling and talking, just like Heather had done, about the trials and tribulations, if you'll excuse the understatement, of their lives before Alcoholics Anonymous, and how they had come to these rooms and done some work and got a sponsor and a home group and worked the steps, and their lives were better. And I felt home. I wasn't obviously identifying with the recovery piece, but I knew you knew me, and already sort of the idea that if I did what you do, I too would get better. And I have to say that that has been my experience. My life was a disaster, not surprisingly, when I got here. I had been teaching a course on social problems without realizing that I was the problem, you know, the social problem. I was frustrated every single day because I felt the students weren't prepared and they weren't hearing me. And the truth is, I would show up in front of them under the influence and completely unprepared myself, and expect them to carry a discussion on a topic that they were there to learn about. So it was ugly. And as I said, I had two small children that I didn't know how to take care of them. And so I did what I could to avoid doing that. And we were about to lose the house, and I was renting a house, and the relationship was ending. So what that did for me is it got me on the phone. I got a sponsor. So I asked Heather to be my sponsor, and she said no, and I thought I would die. I heard you say get a sponsor, and I thought, okay, I can do that. I'll ask this one, you know, person I know. And she said no, and I really thought I would die because I didn't have it in me to ask again. At that first meeting, when it ended, all these women came up to me and gave me their phone numbers. And if you had asked me on that day, I was happy to have your phone number, but not for the reason that you wanted to give it to me. And But you said, get a sponsor, get a home group, start working the steps. And so I, when Heather said no, she couldn't be my sponsor because she had a relationship with my partner, I thought I was going to die, because if that was the thing you have to do to get well here, and the person I asked said no, I couldn't go any farther. And she said, but I know a woman who has the same sponsor that I do, and she'll take you through the steps in the same way that I did. And, you know, while she's not as funny and doesn't laugh and smile quite as much as I am, she will, she'll help you get well. And I, so I went to a meeting and where she was going to be. And at that point, of course, I wasn't lifting my eyes up off the floor. I really was literally looking at the floor the whole time. I had that question in me only once. I couldn't ask her, but she came to me after the meeting and said, I understand you're looking for a sponsor. And I'm like this, uh-huh. And she said, you want it to be me? And I still haven't seen her face, frankly. I'm like, uh-huh. And I mean, she was tall and she wore a suit and she was presentable and she just scared me to death. I thought, how, you know, she was well-groomed. You know, I wasn't, all that stuff. And I was so angry and she was so calm. And she said, do you have a big book? And I said, uh-uh. And so she put her arm around me, unpleasant as I was at that time, and walked me over to the literature table, got me a big book and said, you know, let's get started. So I got my sponsor on a referral. Like, it's not about, do they have what you want? Are they, you know, good enough for me? Which at that time is a ridiculous concept, right? So I was on the phone with her all the time because I had these kids I was terrified of. The relationship ended. My partner sent an email to the landlord saying, I'm moving out and I'm pretty sure Ann can't, you know, pull her weight here, and I want to give you a little heads up that you're probably going to have a problem coming down the road. And I went nuts, of course. I called my sponsor. You won't believe what she wrote in an email to her landlord, blah, 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 blah. And my sponsor said, what are you doing reading her email? I said, wait a minute, you didn't hear what I said. She wrote blah, 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 blah. She's like, Ann, you need to not read her email. I was like, wait a minute. If I say it three times, you're going to believe me, right? So I'm not supposed to read her email, right? And it's none of my business what she thinks of me. Like, all those things that I don't know how to do in the whole world, you know, I learned from calling my sponsor and listening to you people. And, you know, I had these two kids. I'm afraid of. I don't know what to do with them. I don't know how to cook anything. I know how to make, you know, pancakes or something. And so I call my sponsor up and I said, I have to feed them dinner. I don't know what to do. I know how to make pancakes, but I don't know how to make dinner. And she says, give them pancakes and go get a cookbook. Like, and that's how it worked for me. We're reading through the book, and meanwhile, my world is falling apart, and I'm on the phone. I don't have any money. I can't pay the rent. She tells me to have a tag sale. I don't think you understand the magnitude of the problem. A tag sale is probably not going to cover it, but it's some action that you can take in. And so I really, like, everything I know how to do well today, I learned here. We started working the steps. For me, the first step was really clear. I mean, I couldn't not drink. I just couldn't not drink, and my life was a mess. All I had to do was look around. And I'll tell you what, I wasn't excited about the idea that a higher power was going to be the solution in my life, and so I wasn't crazy about the idea of the second step, but I listened and watched you, and I believed absolutely that you had been like me, because from that very first meeting, I heard that you felt the way that I felt, and you were laughing and smiling, and your life looked really good. And so, based on that, I believed that I could be restored to sanity. And that it was as simple as that. And for me, you know, my sponsor gave me direction to get on my knees and pray every day and every night when I first got here. And it's one of those things that I just did because I was told to do it, and I couldn't go on living the way that I had been living. And so that's what I did. And so taking the third step was just sort of the next thing to do. And so together we said the third step prayer, and then she started me writing my fourth step. And I'll tell you, it was during the writing of my fourth step that that I forgave my father. And I had as bad as my relationship with my mother had been, my relationship with my father had been much worse. And I realized, I can't say exactly when it happened, but somewhere in the process of writing out my inventory, I came to see inside, not intellectually, that that I wanted to be forgiven for some of the awful things that I had done. And if I had any hope of being forgiven, I had to forgive him. And just like that, it happened. I really do think I can think my way through an awful lot of things, but this was a visceral experience. It wasn't about the logical thinking that I'm describing. It was about taking a bunch of action, doing some writing, and then being relieved of that terrible, terrible hatred that I had, that had consumed me. And so at the point at which I was going to do my fifth step, you know, I've never come so close to drinking as I did on that, you know, right before there. I thought, if I go share this stuff with another human being, you know, I was just too bad. It was too scary. And there were like 3 package stores I had to pass before I got to my sponsor's house. And, you know, it was God that I didn't stop. And so having shared all of that with another human being, that was one of the first experiences for me. I mean, I had felt the love of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis at every meeting that I went to, on the end of every phone call that I had made. But here's this woman. She gave up 36 hours of her life for me, which, you know, maybe that tells you a little bit about my fourth step as much as it does about her. But she, you know, I spent the night at her house. She cooked for me. She listened to me go on and on and on, and she paid attention, and she nodded and shared some of her own experiences, and I came to know that this is how it works. This is what we do. When it was over, we prayed again, and she told me, this is the best that you can do without a higher power. And so she gave me some direction around 6 and 7. And very shortly after that, I started, and, you know, I made my list and started making amends to people. Among the most powerful amends I made early on were the ones I made to my children. And my daughter by now was about 4 years old, and she had a speech delay, a developmental delay in her speech. So she couldn't say a lot of things. But when I made amends to her, when it was over, she said to me, Mom, I forgive you for, and I forgive you for, and I forgive you for. And she repeated back to me in clear as day exactly what I had told her that I had, the mistakes that I had made with her. That, you know, there's nothing that can replace that. And in that moment, I knew, again, my higher power is amazing. My daughter, who couldn't tell me, you know, what she needed, what she wanted a lot of the time, was very clear. I forgive you for those things. And she was very clear. So I continued on, obviously, made amends to lots and lots of people, had other experiences as powerful as that one. But that was the first really transformative amends experience I had. So, you know, and then I started doing a nightly inventory and cleaning things up and all of that. But I just want to say a couple things about a few experiences I've had in my life today. So, my mom did die, about 10 years ago now, and I was with her. I knew the day she got sick, 2 months before she went into the hospital, we took a cross-country trip to visit my brother and his family in Michigan and had this, I turned 40 and my mom and I and my children traveled across the country to visit my brother and his children. And we got back and within a couple of weeks of that, she went to the doctors, found out that she had in fact cancer. So some things happened and she got very sick and went into, a rehab hospital, and I was with her, and I was able to show up with her through that illness, and when she died, I was holding her hand, and one of the things that my sponsor talked with me about right before my mom died is, you know, is there anything that you need to tell her? Are there any, you know, amends that you still need to make with her? And I was really clear that there was nothing I needed to clean up with my mom. And the only, you know, the emotional feeling that I had was that she wasn't going to share in the rest of my life. I had met someone 6 months before, and I knew we were going to spend the rest of our lives together. And so I said to my mom, I'm really sad that you won't be at our wedding. And I'm really sad that you won't see Mackenzie graduate from high school and college, and you won't be there for her wedding, and you won't, you know. So together we sort of mourned the things that she wouldn't be able to share. And what a gift that was. And that was a gift from Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I got married, and, you know, another really important thing that happened in Alcoholics Anonymous is I got married, and it was the happiest day of my life. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't second to the birth of my first child or any of that. It was the happiest day of my life. We planned it together. We had the most amazing ceremony. We walked into the church and it was full of family members, both biological and our home group members in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the love in that room was unbelievable. The joy, it was incredible. It was, you know, really just the happiest day of my life. And that was a while ago, too. And so today, what my life is like is those two kids that I was terrified of are all grown up now, and we're great friends. They're wonderful young people. We have regular communication. Our daughter just moved back into the house. Our son is not far away. I think he's not coming back anytime soon, though. He's pretty settled. I work in an entirely different field. I'm an elementary school teacher, which, you know what, I'm terrified of kids, and now I teach little kids, so life is good. All the outside stuff that I thought was really going to fix me, that's all in place now, and that's not what makes me happy. You know, if my lawn, if our lawn gets mowed once every 3 weeks, we're really lucky, because we're very busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, but we have a lawn today. It's amazing. Life is really good. And I have the opportunity to be useful in service to Alcoholics Anonymous. Among the things that my sponsor taught me from the very beginning was that you have a service position in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first one I had was that I was greeter and coffee maker at my home group. Maybe there's a few of you here. And I Here's my problem in the end. I think way too much about myself. And the only effective solution to that is to think about somebody else. And when I am greeting at the door, I get to think about somebody else. I learned how to remember your name standing in the doorway because you remembered mine and you gave me a hug. I learned how to hug here. By the time my stint as greeter was up, I was quite certain that there would never be another coffee maker and greeter quite as gifted as me. And I think I stood next to the next guy for a while, pointing out, you know, the ways in which this really needs to be done. And you can ask the guy that's coming after me in the service position I currently hold. Not much has changed in that regard. So I've had the great privilege of serving Alcoholics Anonymous in a number of ways. And in every position, just like that very first one, by the time it's time to, like, I'm confused, they don't know what they were doing, you know, putting me in this position, I don't know what this is about at all. And by the time it's over, I feel like I've got this. I'm pretty sure the next guy, is going to need a lot of assistance. And thank goodness that isn't the truth. My life today is amazing. I'm so privileged to be here. And happy birthday, Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.
Well, our next speaker is Craig, and he's from Connecticut, Area 11.
Thanks, Rich. Good morning. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Craig. Can you guys hear me? All right, I'm glad we got that out of the way. Just thinking about what Rich said when we started the meeting and just thinking about, our first speaker, and just thinking about 80 years ago there being three people on a bed. And I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous is just phenomenal. I mean, the disease of alcoholism doesn't discriminate, and what we're supposed to do in here certainly doesn't discriminate. And you look around this convention, 70,000 people walking all around the city, and everybody's welcome, and everybody has a chance at hope and sobriety, and I think that's wonderful. And I was thinking, I was reflecting the whole time, and I was talking with my girlfriend Marissa on the way in here. I went to the International Convention of Young People in AA in San Antonio this summer in August. And there's a nice story that I just wanted to share with you. It's a very odd story, but it has everything to do with service. It has everything to do with love. It has everything to do with, I think, Alcoholics Anonymous should be and what it did teach me. I was fortunate enough, I was down there doing a panel or something or other, and I was down there at the atrium at the hotel. It was Thursday night. And I'm sitting outside, well, I'm standing outside, and standing outside smoking a cigar. And I see this dog in the atrium, and there's probably about seven or eight people just standing by the dog. And, like, you know, it's a cute doggy. You know, everybody thinks doggies are nice and cute, and petting the doggy and everything. And I saw the dog kind of run off. And I said to myself, that's a stray dog. It's got to be a stray dog. So I ran after the dog, and I got the dog, and the dog didn't look well. It looked dehydrated. It looked sick. It had all kinds of scars on it. It was very skinny. Could barely stand up, and so we took her up to the hotel room. We fed her cold cuts, and a friend of mine who actually lives in San Antonio rescues dogs, and he said, why don't you go to this clinic tomorrow, because they're just going to kill her at this time right now. And at that point, I already named the dog in my head Hope, and so contrary to any suggestions, I stayed in bed with her, as dirty as she was, as nasty as she was. I've slept with worse, and so I stayed in the bed and spent the night, and first thing in the morning, I talked with my friends Darren and Mary, and they drove me over to the clinic in downtown San Antonio. Hey, what's up, guys? Little shout out. And anyways, we went to the clinic. Long story short, there was a woman in that room who was a friend of mine, and I had no idea she was going to be there, and she ended up helping me out. And long story short, we saved Hope's life. We got her the medicine she needed, the care she needed. And probably about a month later, I brought her back to Connecticut. And she's a member of my family now. And the reason I think that's so powerful is I always think of the image of these people almost like greeters outside an AA meeting. not even paying attention to what's going on. I mean, this dog's dying right in front of them. And it's really just all about them playing with the little doggy. And I just think that's a good reminder of me that I should do something with the gift that was given to me, not just pretend I'm doing something. I'm certainly not accusing anyone in here of pretending, but I know for me I can't pretend. It doesn't work. I spent most of my life pretending. And so that's the story of hope and the story of what Alcoholics Anonymous gives me and all the capacities I get to show up in. And God's will is funny because he does work in mysterious ways, and you never know what he's going to do or how he's going to show up. And Rich had mentioned before that I have the honor and privilege to serve as the Area 11 delegate, which is the state of Connecticut, and that's such an honor and gift. And my message, my experience, strength, and hope is unity, recovery, and service. It's all 36 principles. That's what I have to offer. That is my experience, strength, and hope. I don't have something better or less than anybody, but I've been fortunate enough to be given the entire program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I tried to put that forth in front of other folks, and they could decide what they want to do with it. But, you know, in the state of Connecticut, we have over 1,400 groups, 1,800 meetings, 30,000 members, 10 districts. One's a Spanish-speaking district. And to be able to be considered trustworthy to go to the General Service Conference and carry our voice and our message and vote on behalf of Alcoholics Anonymous is just an incredible privilege. And it's something that I wish everybody could experience. I will tell you one thing about that conference that I thought was so powerful this year. There's 130-some-odd voting members sitting in that conference, and we're discussing worldwide issues, stuff about how we should change pamphlets, whether we should have a pamphlet for mental illness, whether we should update the gay and lesbian pamphlet to include a more fair cross-section such as transgender and conformist and stuff like that. And I just saw everybody get to the microphone, and they were all right. Everybody that went to the microphone was right, but it wasn't about being right. It was about what was best for AA. And that's what I learned. I learned the true spirit of the group conscience at the General Service Conference. My sobriety date is November 28, 1998. I haven't drank in over 16 and a half years, and I have a very, very good working knowledge of the traditions and a good understanding of tradition, too. And I've been a member of my home group, and I've served many positions in Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I went to that General Service Conference, the same way when you make that amends that you've denied for years and you have that experience that overwhelming and you never look back, I just felt that way at the conference. I was like, wow. Wow, and I just felt like I was a part of history and a part of the service structure. For me, service is the secret. Somebody up here a few minutes ago mentioned that the way that they stay sober and get healthy is by considering someone else. I was fortunate enough, it was put right in front of me from the beginning that I was going to have to think about you. My solution was thinking about you, not me. I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous at 19. I was already institutionalized. I was in 17 different institutions. I was incarcerated. I've been kicked out of schools, slept on the street floor, woke up in cities I didn't know. My mother didn't want to answer the phone. She couldn't wait to hug me because I was behind a glass in a jail cell on the phone in jail. There was nothing good about my story. There was nothing good. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to be here. And I felt like I was touched right away. I knew that I was never going to drink again, but I didn't know how. I had no idea how that was possible. And I got off this plane in West Palm Beach, Florida. It was very hot, and I had this leather coat on. I'm not sure how I got the leather coat because I didn't have much money, but I had the leather coat. And I got off, and I went to the white van. I went to this treatment center, which I was mandated to go to because of some criminal activity I got involved in. And that started my journey. And my first legitimate sponsor... that I would call an actual sponsor that I worked with, was a tall black man. He was 6'5". He was an ex-gangster from Dallas, and his sponsor was a white racist from Pittsburgh. And it just showed us how we are people who normally do not mix, and they crossed their legs at the front of the men's meeting, and that was my mustard seed, you know, because I was such a tough guy. I was like, I want to cross my legs one day. That was so important to me to be able to sit up in the front of the room and cross my legs. I didn't even think flexibly it was possible, but, you know, it's amazing when you open your mind. What's up, man? It's amazing when you open your mind what's possible. So anyways, I went through the steps because of that, and I got to see what Alcoholics Anonymous was, and I got to see what the whole fellowship was and the whole program. And it's amazing because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I remember being at my first meeting, and you know how you see the shades and stuff on the wall? I looked, and it said, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become manageable. And I sat in meetings for about, I don't know, 2 months, and alcohol was not mentioned. All I heard about was heroin addiction. That's all I heard about. And I have absolutely no qualms with anybody's issues, lest they be alcoholic. I could care less what you do, whether you farm, whether you sell, whether you gamble, but... It didn't make sense to me. I was in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous where it said I'm powerless over, and I didn't hear. And thank God I stayed. Thank God I stayed. And the other thing I realized, which it's funny to fast forward and, you know, watch today, it's amazing our own concept of anonymity as a fellowship. We just, somebody up here said wonderful words. She got sober based on the words, "I don't know." And I think we should say, "I don't know," a little more. And let's find out. And what does it mean? And what does AA mean by anonymity? You know, I just let you know right now, since I have the opportunity to use this medium, please do not take a picture of me when I'm walking in the meeting or anything of that sort. I think anonymity is very sacred. I think we get lost. And the reason I'm saying all this was all common sense stuff to me when I came in. I was a 19-year-old kid off the streets. It was all very simple. It made sense to me. I wasn't educated. I barely got out of high school. I had a GED from a secondary. Well, actually, it's one of those schools you get kicked out of. You get kicked out of another school, you get kicked out of. We had lunch from a roach coat. Played basketball in very bad settings. But so that stuff meant something to me. And, you know, my experience with Alcoholics Anonymous when I came here was not necessarily wonderful within the fellowship. But everything I experienced, I was able to turn that into an asset later on. Everything I had been resentful at, I was able to give back. Because that's what we hear all the time. It's about giving rather than getting. It's about showing up. So every time I was upset that someone didn't come greet me, I made sure that I went and greeted them. I didn't care where you were from, what you did, or how you rolled your eyes at me. I just made sure I was there to say hello. Because I knew if I was going to stay sober, it was no longer about being right. It was about being responsible. And that was a big thing for me, because I didn't know how to do that. I spent all my life being right when I, obviously, once I did a four-step, realized I wasn't. But in my mind, I was always right, and I certainly wasn't willing to admit I was wrong. So I had this experience with my sponsor, and I went through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I became less selfish, the third step for me, the words in the third steps are just so beautiful, to be relieved from the bondage of self. And that's something that I really, really hold true to my heart to this day, is to be relieved from that. Because I remember being stuck inside myself. I remember obsessing over alcohol. I remember thinking about alcohol before I drank, thinking about the eighth or ninth drink when it was ingested, and then thinking about when I was getting the next one after I was done, when I had woke up from a blackout or a binge, or I was incarcerated, institutionalized on top of a building, whatever the case was. I can remember that clear as day. And, you know, sobriety is an amazing thing, because for somebody who could not think about anyone other than himself, for somebody who didn't think he can get over any of his problems, didn't think he was going to be alive by the time he was 25, in sobriety I've lived in 6 or 7 different states. I've had many different jobs, many different relationships. I've lost 2 children. I've had the pleasure of 12-stepping some of my family members and my girlfriend into Al-Anon and watched them grow in the program that works for them. I've certainly done a lot of work for Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's amazing. I always, always want to give back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's not because I'm a great guy. It's because it keeps me sober. And it opens my eyes to so much. Pretty much anything I've ever really, really, truly embraced in my sobriety has come from saying yes to service, sponsorship, a commitment at the home group, something of that sort. And it gives me the opportunity to do something that I don't even know is possible. What I know at this stage of my life is if I say yes, I'm going to see God. I know that. I just need to be careful of how I'm trying to control how I'm going to see God. That's the only issue I need to work on. It's amazing, you stay sober for a little bit and you see more how dishonest you are. You see more how selfish you are. You see more how afraid you are. I remember when I was asked to read How It Works by my first sponsor. He said, go to meetings every day for 6 months and read how it works. I remember reading that, portion of the chapter, you know, how we read it before the meeting. And I genuinely, honestly, delusionally thought that you folks did not know how to be honest. And I knew I was honest. Here I am. I'm in AA. I got a problem. I can admit it. I can't even tell you how much of an awakening the fourth step was to me. And for me to put stuff on paper and see the pattern was just so enlightening. So that third step, to be relieved from the bondage of self, and it's amazing how delusion works, because not only does delusion convince me that I can have a drink, delusion also convinces me that I'm right when I'm not. Delusion convinces me that I know something when I don't, and clearly if I know something, I can't learn. Delusion has almost killed people in my life. Delusion is a very, very controlling and sickening way of thinking, and the fourth step helped me get out of delusion and rely on a power that could relieve me from that. And I went through my fourth step, and much like Ann shared, I mean, I had a major, major issue with my father. Anybody knows my story, that was a big thing for me. I had a very, very big resentment at my father. He had done so much to my mother and I, but what I did when I was sober, I was homeless for my first year and a half sober. So I'm one of those guys, I've toned it down a little bit, but I'm one of those guys that really doesn't want to hear it, that there's no reason you can get sober. And that doesn't mean I'm not compassionate and loving, doesn't mean I'm not just as willing as you are to get sober and help you be sober, but I didn't really want to hear about the excuses. And I'll share that with you about how I work through that. And I understand that we have a lot of thinking that wants us to walk outside the room, but there really is no excuse. There really is none. In my experience, when I trust the higher power, the things I need come to me, whatever they may be. But I had this big resentment on my father, and I had wrote a four-step because I was homeless for like the first year and a half, and I found my father, and I stole money from him. And that's all that was on my side of the street. But I did not want to make amends to this man because of everything he had did. And I was at a meeting one night, and somebody said, any amends you're not willing to make is premeditation to drink. And that just made sense to me. So I knew at one point I was going to have to make amends to my father, and I did. And that was such a relief for me. And I remember there was one point in my sobriety, I was about 15 years sober, and I had made amends with my father, but all I did was correct my wrong. I made my wrong right. I didn't really get into any kind of relationship. And he asked me if I wanted a relationship, and I said no. But at about 15 years sober, I traveled down to Pennsylvania where he was because I wanted to meet him. And I learned a lot about forgiveness that weekend. And I learned a lot about what a fifth step really means, and that everyone has a fifth step. Whether they wrote it down or not, they have one. Whether they shared it with somebody or not, they have one. And I realized that I'm much like this man, and I tried to avoid being like this man all my life. And this man still has no business being a father at all. But for me to be able to sit with him, have dinner with him, to see where all of this comes from and why he is the way he is, and for him to buy me, once around on the go-kart track was pretty cool because I felt like I had a father for a day. So it was good. It was good, you know, because I didn't know what it was like to have a father, and I felt like I had a father for that day. So for me, there it is, showing up with amends and taking a suggestion to give me an opportunity to feel and experience something I need to. And the wonderful thing I like about Alcoholics Anonymous is we choose our own conception of a higher power. We don't need anyone else's. And for me, if God is everything, that also means I could care less what you think about my story. I really could. But I do care about my story, and I know by telling the truth you're going to get some help from it, because I know if I sat in any section of the seating of this auditorium today and you came up here and told the truth, I would get something out of it. Some of us go really far with amends. I know for me, I'm willing to make right anything that I've made wrong, whether it was a principal institution, a treatment center I was at, or a particular location in the city I was in. I want to make everything as right as possible. I've made amends to animals, dogs, properties. I mean, for me, it's important. You know why? Because I think about it, and I feel guilty, and I spent all my life running from guilt, so why not face it? And it's amazing the things I experience and see when I do that. And, sometimes I think I'm crazy even standing up here saying the things I say. I can't believe this is the way I think, especially how I used to think. But that's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. It put me in touch with who I am. And to have a clean side of the street is there's nothing bigger than that. I want to talk about something also with service. I got a few more minutes here. I remember, this is a very simple act I did. I remember I was a huge big book thumper for so long. And believe me, I love the big book. I've still yet to meet someone that knows the big book better than me. And that's a challenge. If you want to talk outside, please see me. I'm not being cocky. I'm just telling you I've yet to meet you. But if you're here, please. I don't want the trophy. I'm just telling you. But I was such a big book thumper. You were doing everything wrong unless you came out of the big book. Which, mind you, for other big book thumpers in here, the 12 traditions are in the big book. The 12 concepts are in the big book. The medical view for AA is in the big book. Every single piece of pamphlet that AA produces is in the big book. So let's just open our minds a little. And I'm embarrassing myself here, not you. Anyways, I was involved in service, and I was such a big book thumper. I was one of those guys that was so into the big book that you weren't allowed to read the 12 and 12. It was inappropriate, because if you read page 17 of the 12 and 12, it says that these essays were made to broaden and deepen your horizons on the 12 steps. So, of course, it fits my agenda. You need to get rid of the 12 and 12 and just keep the big book. Never mind what the General Service Conference or the Group Conscious of Alcoholics Anonymous thinks, but this is what I thought. So I was involved in special needs, languages in remote communities, and there was a Vietnam veteran who couldn't read his small print 12 and 12 anymore. And it was my job to get him a 12 and 12, and he wanted a large print 12 and 12. And I got that 12 and 12, and I rode out to his trailer home, and I handed him the 12 and 12, and he had the biggest smile on his face. He was just so happy that he was able to read his 12 and 12. And that's what service has taught me, that my ambitions and everything I think I know is not necessarily the case. It was that simple act, by willing to be of service, by being involved in the group conscience and my position within the district, that I was able to overcome that ego and that arrogance and stuff of that sort. And I really don't know how to explain the joy. I mean, I'm sure I don't look like it right now, but I feel like a Care Bear with a bunch of light coming out of my stomach. I'm so overwhelmed for Alcoholics Anonymous. But I just, 20 minutes is ridiculous. I mean, how are you supposed to get all that out? But the best thing I can tell you, is, as you in this room already know, it's indescribably wonderful. And that's my experience with service. It is indescribably wonderful. There is not one thing I have done that has not opened my mind to something new. There is not one thing that I've done with service where I haven't met new friends, new networks, put myself in positions to do things I didn't know I would do, actually made my life outside of just the AA circle and the service circle better. One of the coolest things I ever did, my sponsor had just heard my 48-hour, well, not just, but he had heard my fifth step, which was about 48 hours. It was a very long fifth step, and he spent time with it. Yeah, I had four legal pads filled with resentments and fears and my conduct and how I harmed others, and he spent time with me. And I had moved up to Danbury, Connecticut at the time, and I was at the 24-hour Starbucks. And there was a gentleman that came up to me at 1 in the morning and said, "Listen, I don't trust my sponsor. Would you be willing to hear my fifth step?" And I said, "Absolutely." And I said, "We're going to go to my office." And I didn't have an office. It was a commuter lot. But we went into the commuter lot, and we sat there, and I listened to his fifth step until the wee hours of the morning, 5:36 in the morning. And I had to be at work at 6:30. And whenever I show up, God takes care of me. I had no problem getting to work. And I got to work, and I did fine at work. But I got to experience the joy of listening to someone's fifth step and giving back what somebody has did to me. Everything I've done in my life, there's nothing better. There is nothing better than sitting across from another drunk, sharing experience rather than hope, listening to a fifth step, being involved in service. The places it takes you, the things you see is just incredible. And I want everybody to see that and hear it and feel it. And I feel so passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous and keeping it alive. And in my experience, we have a lot of pink elephants in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the biggest pink elephants I think we have is anonymity. And I mentioned it a few minutes ago. We're so afraid of it. We don't know what it is. I think we should carry the message using the principles of anonymity. I think it's okay to carry the message using it, but we should be anonymous. We should have AA on shopping carts. We should have AA on billboards. We should have AA in the newspapers, not Craig or Joe or Bill or Eddie. It's interesting because in 2000, the General Service Conference made a decision on posthumous anonymity. Posthumous anonymity is basically the co-founders. And we made a decision that we would no longer put pictures of the co-founders. I mean, Bill's last message in the 50s, I'm sorry, he died in the 70s. Bill's last message in the 70s of everything and anything he could have talked about was about anonymity. He could have talked about anything, and he talked about anonymity back in the 70s. I just think it's so important. I think I heard something. I know Rich wants to say a few words, so give me just a few more minutes here. I was in one of the hospitalities, and I was speaking with a lady who does ASL translation, interpretation. And we've been trying to connect with the deaf community in the greater Hartford area in Area 11, and because we need them and we want them and we want to hear their voice, and they're a fair cross-section of the state of Connecticut. And we just haven't been able to get them out to connect with our service structure and or our meetings. And I asked this woman, I said, "Well, what do you think one of the reasons is?" And she said, "Anonymity." Because in the deaf community, once you're labeled, that's it. So that's like really big for them. It's really big for them. And they're afraid. I just think that's something we should hear and consider. In 2015, our own members are afraid to connect to us because of anonymity. This is the last story, I promise, and I'll sit down. When I moved to Danbury, Connecticut, I sat in a Big Book meeting, and there was a Spanish individual who was going to the El Dorado Big Book every day, and he didn't speak any English. And I read a vision for You every night because I had just moved, and it was always important for me to just try to get outside of my head and see what I could bring. You know those people like, "Oh, this meeting stinks. Nobody's carrying the message. Oh, there's nobody there." I don't do that. I carry the message God gives me. That's it. You don't have to complain. Just carry the message. You'll be fine. That's my experience. So I went there, and I thought about it, and I saw the guy, and I said I wanted to start a Spanish group. And that's what I did, and I don't speak any Spanish. And I got with some of the members of District 9.6, which is our Spanish linguistic district, and we started a Spanish meeting in Danbury, and it was called Mi Esperanza, which means my hope. And it was in Danbury, and it was there for a year. The meeting was there for a year. And the most important thing about that wasn't just that we started a Spanish meeting or a bunch of the English-speaking community connected with the Spanish community. The most important thing we learned is there was an AA meeting, a Spanish AA meeting, that was there already for 16 years. But nobody knew about it. So next time you make fun of a group for having a GSR, you better wake up. That's why you need a GSR, because drunks are dying if you're not represented within the service structure. And that's my message. My message is that of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to be involved, to open your mind, to use all of it. And that's what saved my life. The general service structure is here for a reason, just as well as the recovery, the steps, the unity, all of it. And we have to be engaged in all of it. There's so much you could do with your membership. And I have a lot to learn, and I'd like to learn it from you, but I can only learn it from you if you're involved. Thanks for a few minutes. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. That was great, brother.